You're tuned into This Week in Palestine, a space grounded in truth, resistance, and radical solidarity. This is where voices from the heart of occupation rise to meet global movements fighting for justice, dignity, and liberation. Each week, we deliver uncompromising reporting, sharp analysis, and raw, unfiltered commentary that centers Palestinian life while tracing the fault lines of empire, racism, and repression across the globe. From the mechanics of policy and propaganda to the grit of daily survival and the pulse of international activism, we examine the systems that shape Palestine and how those same systems echo from Ferguson to Jenin, from refugee camps to college campuses. A quick note, the views expressed during this hour belong to our hosts and guests and do not necessarily reflect those of WZBC, Boston College, or its Board of Trustees. This isn't a space for polite avoidance or sanitized soundbites. It's a space for truth, bold, urgent, and unapologetic. We're grateful you're here. Let's begin. You are listening to This Week in Palestine, Truth and Justice Radio. Good morning. Good evening, wherever you're tuning in from across the globe. Thank you for joining us. I'm your host, Muhammad Al Ghul, and it's a deep honor to welcome you back to This Week in Palestine. Today is Sunday, August 17, 2025. And once again, our focus returns to Gaza and the West Bank, lands under siege, where homes are shattered, lives uprooted, and voices too often drowned out by global indifference. As headlines fade and attention shifts, the reality remains: families endure displacement, communities resist with unshakable resolve, and the struggle for dignity continues against staggering odds. And still, one haunting question echoes: how long must a people suffer before the world chooses conscience over convenience and action over apathy? Stay with us as we uncover truth, uplift resilience, and carry forward the flame of justice. This journey is not mine alone. It's ours. It's shared. And it's sacred. Last Thursday, early afternoon, I was driving through the traffic lights at Newton Center when something stopped me. A gathering of people holding Palestinian flags and signs that read "Jews against starving Gaza." Newton Center, just a few miles from Boston College, was the last place I expected to see that kind of public solidarity. And yet, there it was, a quiet but powerful rupture in the narrative. After October 7th, nearly every house in this area displayed signs reading, "We stand with Israel." It was overwhelming, but slowly those signs began to vanish. Now you only see them every few blocks and mostly outside synagogues. What's happening isn't just symbolic. It's a shift I've been saying would come with the next generation. But it's not just coming, it's already here. Forget the governments. Forget the congressmen and senators bought and silenced by IPAC and the Israeli lobby. The real change is happening on the ground, in the hearts and minds of ordinary people. And it's happening across faiths, across communities. Let's be clear, Judaism is not Zionism. Judaism is a faith rooted in justice, memory, and compassion. Zionism, especially in its current form, is a political ideology built on displacement, militarism, and domination. It is Zionism, not Judaism, that calls for the starvation of Gaza and the theft of Palestinian land. And history has its own uncomfortable truths. Some Zionist factions collaborated with fascist regimes, including the Nazis, in the 1930s, negotiating deals that prioritized settlement over solidarity. These facts are documented, even if rarely acknowledged. The world is beginning to see Zionism for what it is: not a movement for safety, but a project of control. And those who proudly wear the label today may one day regret what it has come to represent. The shift is real. The silence is breaking, and the truth is rising. What I witnessed in Newton Center is part of a growing rupture, a visible, undeniable shift in public consciousness. The sight of Jewish Americans standing with Palestine, carrying signs that read "Jews against starving Gaza," in a town once saturated with "We Stand with Israel" placards, is not just symbolic, it's seismic. This isn't just generational change. It's moral awakening. Across the country, Jewish voices are breaking ranks with Zionist institutions. Groups like If Not Now, Jewish Voice for Peace, and TRUA have mobilized thousands in protest, some even risking arrest to say, "Not in our name." In New York, Over 40 Jewish activists were detained for protesting outside Trump International Hotel, demanding an end to Israel's siege on Gaza. In Los Angeles, rabbis are hosting roundtables to confront the humanitarian crisis, and polling shows that over half of Jewish Americans now lack confidence in Netanyahu's leadership. What's happening now is a reckoning. The younger generation, Jewish, Muslim, Christian, secular, is watching genocide unfold in real time. They are not buying the propaganda. They are not afraid to speak out. And they are not going to inherit the silence of their predecessors. The signs are disappearing. The masks are falling. And the truth is rising. The world is shifting and Israel is losing its mask. The global tide is turning. Not at the level of governments, which remain entangled in lobbies and diplomatic deals, but among the people. From Athens to Toronto, from the islands of Greece to the streets of Newton Center, ordinary citizens are rising up and rejecting the narrative that once shielded Israel from accountability. Take Greece, for example. Once considered Israel's second closest ally after Germany, it is now a center of daily mobilizations against the genocide in Gaza. Tens of thousands have marched in over 100 cities and islands, chanting victory to the resistance and end genocide in Palestine. Greek port workers have blocked Israeli cruise ships. Protesters have declared, "Zionists not welcome." And in a moment of piercing clarity, Greek officials told Israel, "We don't accept lessons in democracy from those who kill civilians and children." This is not a fringe movement. It's a rupture in public conscience. Meanwhile, Israeli immigration to Greece has surged up nearly 90% in recent weeks, driven by those seeking refuge through the Golden Visa program, which offers residency to foreign investors. But even that escape route is being met with resistance. Greek communities are refusing to normalize genocide. They are refusing to offer sanctuary to war criminals. And it's not just Greece. In Canada, dual Israeli-Canadian citizens who served in the IDF are now afraid to return home. The Royal Canadian Mounted Police has launched a war crimes investigation into alleged atrocities committed in Gaza. Some reservists fear arrest at the border. Others have canceled travel plans altogether. This is what happens when the truth breaks through the propaganda. Israel's military campaign has killed over 61,000 Palestinians, most of them civilian. Hospitals, refugee camps, journalists, and aid convoys have been targeted. And now the world sees what many Palestinians have known for decades. Israel's army does not fight wars, it wages terror. Without U.S.-supplied F-16s and F-35s, it would never face Palestinians one-on-one. Its strength lies in its machinery, not its morality. And morality matters. The world is beginning to understand that this is not a conflict, it's a crime. That this is not defense, it's domination. And that those who carry out these crimes will be held accountable. Whether in The Hague, in Canadian courts, or in the court of public opinion, war criminals have no place in civil society. Israel is facing a level of international isolation not seen in decades. According to recent reports, 56% of Israelis are now afraid to travel abroad due to global criticism, and 61% fear being physically attacked while overseas. What was once unthinkable is now reality. Israelis are becoming international outcasts, and the hostility toward them has doubled since May, fueled by the famine in Gaza and the mounting evidence of war crimes. The Israeli government and its media outlets call this backlash anti-Semitism. But the world sees something else, a regime starving civilians, bombing hospitals, and targeting aid workers. The outrage is not against Judaism, it's against Zionism weaponized as a tool of domination. Take what happened to Itamar Ben-Gvir, Israel's far-right security minister. During his visit to New York City, he was chased by protesters, threatened, and told plainly, "We know who you are. You are not welcome here." This wasn't a fringe protest, it was a public reckoning. Across the globe, thousands of Israelis are facing backlash. In the United States, there were 8,873 documented incidents against Israelis in 2023, a 140% increase over the previous year. That number doubled again 2024 and 2025, culminating in the May 2025 attack on Israeli embassy staff in Washington, D.C. And tragically, innocent Jews are paying the price for the crimes committed in their name. Many are being targeted simply for being perceived as Israeli, even as they protest against the genocide in Gaza. Jewish Americans have taken to the streets to denounce Israel's actions, only to be attacked by Zionist counter-protesters. The numbers are staggering. In Canada, incidents against Israelis rose by 670% in 2024. In Australia, anti-Semitic attacks quadrupled, with over 2,000 incidents recorded between October 2023 and September 2024. In the UK, incidents increased by 100%, while in France, they surged by 300% in early 2024. Germany documented over 1,383 incidents targeting Israelis. Similar surges have been reported in Italy, Spain, Belgium, Finland, Switzerland, and beyond. In Ireland, a restaurant owner made headlines for kicking out the British Prime Minister, citing the UK's complicity in the Gaza genocide. In Greece, Israeli cruise ships were blocked from docking, and Israeli tourists were told, "Zionists not welcome." This is not a temporary backlash. This is a global reckoning. Even celebrities once silent are now speaking out. Artists, athletes, and public figures are distancing themselves from Israel, refusing to perform, collaborate, or endorse a regime that has become synonymous with apartheid and brutality. The Israeli newspaper Yedioth Ahronoth calls it a diplomatic tsunami, and they're right. Israel is being ostracized, boycotted, and condemned at a scale not seen since the darkest chapters of the 20th century. This is not about hate. It's about accountability. And the message is clear. Zionism is not Judaism. Judaism is a faith. Zionism, in its current form, is a political ideology that has led to mass displacement, systemic violence, and genocide. The world is waking up. The tide is turning. And the consequences are unfolding in real time. The shift is happening. The silence is breaking. And the chase for justice has begun. The collapse of complicity, a new era of accountability. Let's say it plainly, Israel is not going to last, not in its current form, not with its current policies, and not with the global tide turning against it. That may sound radical to some, but look around. The signs are everywhere. Israel is facing unprecedented international isolation, described by Yedioth Ahronoth as a diplomatic tsunami. Global favorability has plummeted in 42 out of 43 countries polled since the war on Gaza began. Even longtime allies like Germany, France, and Canada have issued joint statements condemning Israel's actions and threatening concrete consequences. The United Nations has warned that Israel's siege and displacement policies in Gaza amount to genocide. And the people? They're done. The people are no longer asking the elected officials how they'll support Israel. They're asking how they'll hold Israel accountable. That shift from blind allegiance to moral scrutiny is seismic. And it's happening fast. The Israeli lobby, especially IPAC, has poured hundreds of millions of dollars into U.S. elections to silence critics and unseat progressive voices. But their grip is slipping. Candidates who once feared speaking out are now being backed by grassroots movements demanding justice for Palestine. The next wave of elected officials will not be beholden to IPAC. They'll be accountable to the people. And if they want to hold a seat, they'll need to hold Israel to account. This isn't just political theory. It's already happening. IPAC spent $25 million to defeat Rep. Jamal Bowman for supporting a ceasefire. Progressive candidates are being targeted, but they're fighting back with public support growing louder by the day. Voters are organizing around Palestine as a litmus test for integrity, not a taboo. So no, it's not crazy to say Israel is heading toward collapse. If it continues down this path, genocide, apartheid, impunity, it will lose the last threads of legitimacy it clings to. And when the people rise, when the ballots reflect conscience, when the lobby loses its grip, the system will fall. This is not a prophecy. It's a warning. And it's also a promise. We will hold them accountable. You are listening to This Week in Palestine, Truth and Justice Radio. Today on This Week in Palestine, we bring you a compelling conversation with Rabbi David Feldman of Netzarei Karta International, a Jewish organization known for its unwavering opposition to Zionism and its vocal support for Palestinian liberation. Rabbi Feldman is part of a tradition that distinguishes Judaism from Zionism, challenging the mainstream narrative that equates support for Israel with Jewish identity. In gatherings from Washington, D.C. to Istanbul, he has spoken boldly about the crimes committed in Gaza and the theological and moral reasons why many Orthodox Jews reject the existence of the Israeli state. In this episode, Rabbi Feldman shares his perspective on what it means to be anti-Zionist as a Jew, why supporting Israel is not synonymous with supporting Jewish values, and how Nitzarei Karta continues to stand in solidarity with Palestinians, often at great personal and political cost. This is not just a religious stance, it's a moral one. And it's a voice that many try to silence, but today, we're amplifying it. Let's dive in.
Rabbi David Feldman, thank you so much for sitting here with us today. And we're filming this interview at a time where student activists across the U.S. are being arrested for their pro-Palestine activism with claims that they're being anti-Semitic. What's your take on all of this?
Well, accusing people who stand up for the oppressed, people who say something when they see crimes taking place, this is not anti-Semitic. You know, doing what's right and speaking up for the oppressed is not anti-Semitic in any way. When these people, when these students, it's not only the students, it's so many other people are being attacked with this false accusation of anti-Semitism. This is disturbing because in the time, as you say, in the time that we see this genocide going on in Gaza, so many people, tens of thousands of people are being mass murdered, innocent people. This is something that us, people in the free world, should say something. This is unjust. This is unjust for the people of Palestine that this voice is attempted to be silenced. But it's not only doing injustice for the Palestinian people, this is doing injustice for the Jewish people as well. Because when you conflate Judaism and Zionism, you conflate anti-Zionism with anti-Semitism, you're making a statement as if all Jews support all what's going on and as if all Jews are accountable to what's going on. But we always need to know better than that. And we try to educate people to understand that anti-Zionism has nothing to do with anti-Semitism, because Judaism and Zionism are not the same. Judaism is a religion. Zionism is a political movement. Should never be conflated.
Yes, and New York is one of the hot spots, shall we say, of Judaism, with over 2 million Jews living in this city. And as you say, some of them are anti-Zionist, but meanwhile, some of them are support the state of Israel and, you know, identify as Zionist. And sometimes we see them confronting you because of your stance. What's your take on them?
Well, first of all, as you say, New York is a very good example. Yes, there are a lot of Jewish people in New York. Many of them support Israel, but there's a massive community who is anti-Zionist. And people might not know because the mainstream media would never show you that. Like, for example, there was a couple of years ago, there was a huge mass anti-Zionist rally, a Jewish anti-Zionist rally in front of the Israeli consulate on 2nd Avenue, Manhattan. And then CBS would announce that there is a traffic jam on 2nd Avenue. And they would not say what the reason is. In other words, they purposely, intentionally ignore what is going on. So many people have no idea. But there is a massive religious Jewish anti-Zionist community who are outspokenly against Israel. What's important to understand is that these, not everyone comes out in each and every occasion. Mm-hmm. As you say, intimidation is massive. Pressure is enormous. I always tell this story. I had a very close friend of mine comes over to me once and tells me, I'll do everything I can to support you, to support your activities, but there's no way I can come out in person. I run a huge business. I come out in person, they take a picture of me, I closed down the business the same day, but still, the anti-Zionism is strong. Our communities are very strong, and you can imagine if it wouldn't have been for those massive communities that will be behind us, we would not be able to be out there in these numbers and this so frequent and do so much.
Yes, you have huge numbers behind you, but also we're seeing Zionist groups like Betar recently becoming more emboldened and seeking to confront you. Can you speak on the activities of Zionist groups such as Betar?
Well, Betar, to begin with, I'm not sure how large they are, how strong they are. They might be very wild. They might be very aggressive. We didn't see them in large numbers. But yes, they are very aggressive. They are coming out in public, intimidating, harassing demonstrators. Happens to be peaceful demonstrators. You know, these demonstrations taking place in New York City that we all attend. These are not dangerous demonstrations, and these people will always claim that the pro-Palestinian solidarity movement is dangerous, and so on.
Yeah, and sometimes they approach you, they tell you things like, you should go to Gaza, you won't be safe in Gaza. How do you respond to that?
Oh, that's a good point. What they say is, yeah, go visit Gaza. And they always they also say, you know, go to the Arabs, they will kill you first. And I always respond to that, and usually these arguments end up with nothing, because they don't know what's going on whatsoever. And I try always to tell these people, and people who are willing to listen, and some people are willing to listen, and I tell them, you know, why are you so scared from these Palestinian people? They don't hate you. They don't want anything. They just want their freedom. We can live in peace with them. We lived in peace with them before Zionism came. They were always respectful for Jews, and they still are. But in the same time, they are deeply upset and against the crimes being committed to Palestine, which doesn't make these people anti-Semitic, doesn't make these people dangerous for Jews. While in the same time, yes, those people are vehemently opposing this occupation of Palestine. Now, when you find people on the street protesting the genocide in Gaza, this is not about protesting the Jewish people. This is not about protesting the Jewish religion. This is about crimes and which they are opposed to. And we as Jewish people share their frustration, and we share their pain of people who are disturbed when all of this is taking place.
What do you say to those who maybe agree with what you're saying, but also say that Jewish people need a strong Israel to be safe?
This is one of the arguments that the Zionists are using, that Jewish people suffered in the Holocaust. We are in exile for the past 2,000 years. It's about time for us to have a safe haven. And most of the time, this is being religion is being used into these conversations. They are trying to use religion, some concepts of the Jewish religion, to justify this claim. But what one needs to understand is basically two points. First of all, this is not Judaism. According to Judaism, we are forbidden to create this so-called safe haven for the Jewish people. According to the very basics of Judaism, there's a concept of Jewish exile, which is a divine decree, which we are forbidden to end by any physical means, even if we find that this building is a safe haven would be in our favor. According to our religion, this is forbidden. We accept the decree of God, whether it is comfortable or it isn't. We accept the word of God that we should not end this exile by any physical means. And we leave this up to God for Him to end our exile. This is exactly what Judaism teaches us, that it's only God, God Himself, that will bring the ultimate redemption, where all humanity together will serve the one God in peace and brotherhood. Zionism is forbidden. Safe haven is Zionism. But I have to add this other point. All of this would be true even if this would have been the safe haven for the Jewish people, even if this would have been the favor of Jews. But it happens to be that the state of Israel is the greatest danger for the Jewish people. While we lived in Palestine in peace, it is the occupation of Palestine which has destroyed this peace. And And in addition, I have to add that, coming back to the previous point, even if this would have been in the favor of the Jewish people, we should never oppress another people. We should never harm another people because it might be in our interest.
Certainly very interesting points you're making there, philosophically and religiously, very interesting arguments. But Zionists often use religious arguments to justify the existence of Israel. How do you respond to those claims? And also, Zionists equate Judaism together with Zionism. And what's your take on that?
Zionists are conflating Judaism with Zionism because they need Judaism to support their movement of Zionism. But what happens here is something very ironic and very hypocritical. You have a movement of Zionism, which is officially a secular movement. It's not only secular, because the founders of Zionism and the people, the Zionists today, are not only secular, they basically, many of them, hate Judaism. They hate God and his religion. For example, I have a friend of mine who grew up in Zionist education, grew up in Jerusalem. And he told me that what he was taught is that we, the Jewish people, have two enemies. Now guess who the two are and who the first is. The first is the religious Jew, and the second is the Arab. Mm. Now, both of this is wrong. The religious Jew is basically the Jew. But this is how they hate religion, the Jewish religion, and they hate religious Jews, which just shows you how far away they are from Judaism. But that movement, the movement of Zionism, who is secular and who refuses to follow Judaism, they misuse this very same religion they refuse to follow, and they misuse it to justify crimes which are forbidden in this very same religion, because killing and stealing, oppressing an entire people, all of this is forbidden in Judaism. And as I said before, the whole concept, the idea of Zionism to build a sovereign homeland for Jews is in total contrast of Judaism. Now, seeing a secular movement misusing the religion doesn't make sense in the first place. But what my response to those people is, we can only explain and educate that while you are misusing the Jewish religion, in each and every way is in total contrast to this movement of Zionism.
And when we take a look at what's happening right now, overall in the Middle East with President Trump taking office, he ran as being a president for peace, and he promised that he can bring peace not only to the Middle East, but to Ukraine and many other regions. How is your take on how his administration, their policies have been so far, and do you have hope for peace?
Now, I'm not a politician. Now, I'm not sure exactly what can be done in each and every conflict around the world. But when it comes to Zionism, it comes to Palestine, what we are presenting is, we are presenting the view of Judaism, of our religion. And yes, we do see the approach that our president of the United States has taken. We always say to politicians, we appreciate when politicians or individuals extend the hand for the Jewish people. We definitely appreciate. But we try to educate and to explain that supporting Israel is not in favor of the Jewish people. Supporting Israel is doing so much harm to the suffering people of Palestine and so much harm for the Jewish people. We do everything we can to explain, to educate, that Judaism is not Zionism.
And in this climate, when some are afraid of speaking out, as you said, they're worried about losing their businesses, how important is it for Jewish voices like yours to speak out for Palestine?
Well, it is extremely important for us to speak up for many reasons. First of all, the oppressed people of Palestine deserve that people in the free world should speak up. And without Jewish people coming out, the rest of humanity is being intimidated, of being anti-Semitic. This is one of the reasons why it's so important for Jewish people to come out and to help people overcome this propaganda and understand that this is a human cause, this is a righteous cause, this is a cause that needs to be addressed, and we all share this very important cause.
Mm-hmm.
And in addition to this is so important because we have to break this stereotype. People should know that not all Jews take part in this. No. Jewish people who are right-minded people disagree with all of this. The state of Israel does not represent us. It certainly doesn't represent our religion. If there is a group of people supporting these crimes, you know, that's their own decision. But this is not the voice of the entire Jewish people.
When you speak to Jewish people who are kind of on the fence, they're not Zionists, but maybe when they see you, they see that there's an alternative path they can take. Can you speak to those conversations? Maybe not some who are set in their ways, but some who you can actually change their perspective.
There are many people, especially since October 7th, so many people are waking up. So many people are seeing something new that they didn't realize until now. You know, until now everything was like okay, but now they are waking up to see that something is wrong. And these people are willing, some of them are willing to listen. In my experience, the Zionist propaganda is so strong and so massive that even if you would find some people who are not supposed to be Zionist, who in essence are not Zionist, but the movement of Zionism has managed to confuse the masses, the Jewish people are in danger. It's those enemies of ours who seek to destroy us all, and they want to drive us into the sea. From the river to the sea, people are so disturbed by this slogan, from the river to the sea. And I speak to people and I try to explain them. What do you think is the second half of this slogan, from the river to the sea? Kill all the Jews? And people say yes. People believe that from the river to the sea, Palestine wants to see all Jews killed, which is so ridiculously wrong. It doesn't make any sense. And I always explain to people, Palestine doesn't want to see Jewish people dead. They don't even want to see all Jews expelled from Palestine. That's not what they are saying. All they want is total freedom for their people and free their land. And we spoke to so many political leaders of the Palestinian groups, so many religious leaders, so many individuals, layman people. Nobody says otherwise. But unfortunately, people following Zionist propaganda are so misled to the point that they even lose their mind to be able to figure out what's in the best interest for themselves. Let's put the oppressed people of Palestine aside, which is something that everyone should think about. But even for their own interest, like they are fighting for the Jewish people. And by doing so, they are endangering all Jews. Like by supporting what Israel is doing, this is not in favor of the Jewish people. But I'm pleased to see that people are listening. And we do this already for decades, but especially since October 7th, people are opening their minds. And, you know, they see that they have to rethink what they were programmed until now. And they slowly open their minds.
And can you give a bit of a more personal perspective? Your family escaped Europe back in the days. They escaped genocide. So being a sort of a survivor of genocide, what kind of responsibility does that put on you, on your shoulders, to speak out when it's happening?
We always say it's because it's our communities who suffered in the Holocaust. It's our families who suffered in the Holocaust. That's a lesson for us, that we should not want to see this happen to anyone. When we are seeing what's happening in Gaza, this reminds us of the stories that our elders told us just a couple of decades ago. A number of my teachers were Holocaust survivors. And you know, they were telling stories, terrible stories. And unfortunately, we're hearing similar stories now. This is something that should, the Jewish history in the Holocaust should be a lesson for Jewish people, how to refuse this genocide taking place in Gaza.
So, turning to the future of Jewish and Palestinian solidarity, what do you think needs to happen in the U.S. so that more Jewish people support the Palestinian cause like you do?
Basically, they need information. They need education. They need to realize not only that what's being done to Palestine is wrong, but even more importantly, they need to know that Palestine is not the enemy of the Jewish people, and they never were. There's a massive propaganda that is ingrained in their minds from their very young age, mm-hmm. but this needs to be corrected. Mm-hmm. And once this will be corrected, we can get we can proceed further.
And going forward, some people are very unhopeful for the future of Gaza. What do you see happening now that the ceasefire has been broken again? The Netanyahu government seems to want to keep pushing to exterminate the Palestinian people from the land. What do you see happening?
I'm not sure exactly what's going to happen in Gaza. I hope for the best. But generally speaking with Palestine, I see a better future. Why? Because we see, at least since October 7th, even before, people are waking up. The general public is changing their views. Public opinion is shifting. Maybe we have to give credit to Netanyahu for waking up the people. I always say, it's so sad when we have to pay this terrible price for people to wake up. So many people, so many tens of thousands of people need to be murdered for people to finally wake up. But this is what's happening.
But while they're waking up on one end, but also on the other end, here in the U.S., there's a lot of crackdown against pro-Palestine demonstrations. As we mentioned earlier, people are getting snatched up of the street. Do you have any worries for you, for your community, because you're standing up for Palestine? Could something happen to you?
Well, it can happen. It can happen. But to be clear here, this is not showing that it's not being successful. On the other way around, we see this as success. If there is no response to the pro-Palestinian solidarity movement other than physically cracking them down, then this is an achievement. In other words, there is no other reasonable response.
And how has this response been? Has there been threats against you, against your community?
Well, we have threats from time to time. We have physical attacks from time to time. It's okay. It's okay. You know, we expect this to happen. We expect that the other side is strong and aggressive. But again, this is encouraging because this is all they can respond with. They have no logical or reasonable or proper religious argument to make here.
So in the face of threats, you're actually saying that this means that your activism is working because now people are getting worried and they're taking backlash against you. But we're also seeing backlash to students, such as the Turkish student who was recently arrested, Rumeysa Öztürk, Mahmoud Halil, a student from Colombia who perhaps you demonstrated with very closely. What's your message to these students out there who are maybe worried and who are looking for guidance on what to do in this time?
Well, all we can say is, yes, it's difficult. Yes, it's challenging. But in the same time, we, all of us, know that what we are doing is right. I cannot necessarily advise people exactly what to do and not to do. That's the choice of the individuals in the face that we can face backlash. But we are speaking up for humanity. We are doing a righteous deed. We please God by our acts. And this is what needs to be done. Now, who should be those doing it? That's up to the individual.
And can you talk about a bit about your experiences when you went to Gaza or when you've been to other countries in the Middle East? How were you received by the people there? Perhaps like you can explain it in a way for other Jewish people who've never been. What would their experience be if they went?
This is a very important question, because our personal experience is shocking for general Jewish people. We visited Gaza, and this was after the beginning of the siege. This was in 2009. Gaza is the most affected people from this conflict, from this war. And people were questioning before we went whether it's going to be safe, because after all, you know, these people should be dangerous to people who harm them. But this wasn't the case. They knew exactly who we were. They knew that we're not the enemy. They had no problem with us as Jewish people. We met Ismail Haniyeh, who was the prime minister of Gaza at the time. And he said to us, privately in a meeting and then publicly in a press conference, he said, "We have nothing against the Jewish people, neither against the Jewish religion. We are against the occupation." This makes simple sense. I always take these stories back to our communities and I tell the people, Palestine is not dangerous to the Jewish people. I visited Gaza. I visited many other Muslim countries. Frequently, I visit Muslim or Arab conventions. And guess what? I came home alive. It's not dangerous at all. People need to know this. And people who only follow mainstream media or Zionist media, generally speaking, they don't have even a chance to interact with any Palestinian or Muslim to have personal experience, mm-hmm. which is very unfortunate, because their information is being built on fabricated propaganda versus facts on the ground.
That was Rabbi Feldman offering a powerful and principled critique of Zionism from within the Jewish tradition. His words remind us that truth often lives in the margins spoken by those willing to risk comfort for conscience. Now we pivot to another voice of clarity and disruption, Professor Richard D. Wolff, a renowned Marxist economist and host of Economic Update. In this short clip, Wolff challenges the illusion of normalcy in our economic system. He asks, how is it that so few people see what's happening right in front of them? From corporate control to media distraction, Wolff lays bare the hidden architecture of inequality and manipulation. His analysis isn't just about numbers, it's about power, silence, and the stories we're told to keep us compliant. Listen closely, not just to what he says, but to what his words reveal about the world we live in and the forces shaping it behind the scenes.
The world is not going to forget what Israel did in Gaza. The last desperate gasps of white colonialism trying to control what we now call the global south. The resistance of the people of Gaza, it's absolutely extraordinary. The horror of what is going on in Israel, what they've done to the people of Gaza. We're going to be talking about that. Well, let me give you an example. This week was the 80th anniversary of the dropping of the atomic bomb on the Japanese cities of Hiroshima and Nagasaki. 80 years ago, that happened. It is the only time in the history of the human race that nuclear weapons were used by one country against the citizens of another country. And we, the Americans, bear the guilt of having done that, of having taken that extraordinary step that no other country ever took. And so there were celebrations around the world, not so much in the United States, which you can kind of understand, because it's hard for Americans to look at the pictures that you can see of what those atomic bombs did. But we will never forget that. That's why we're we see celebrations around the world. Well, the world is not going to forget what Israel did in Gaza. It is a stain upon the history and the reputation of Israel. And because of the peculiar relationship between Israel as a country and Jewish people all over the world, it's going to be a burden for those Jewish people to carry. Not that they need it, but they will have no choice because of the actions of Mr. Netanyahu and the people of his government. And yes, Americans are simply among those people around the world that are horrified. Long ago, the government in Ireland recognized the Palestinians as a separate people and broke their relationships with Israel. Spain has done it. We recently saw that the French are about to do it. Even the British are talking about it. The only country of any significance that supports Israel at this point, given what it has done and is doing, is the United States. And of course, thoughtful people across the political spectrum, even among MAGA folks, yes, there is the question, and it's been there a while. Is this a smart move? To connect the United States with something that every Arab person and every Muslim person around the world sees as a horrific assault on their co-religionists, the people that they share a religious belief with. I mean, try to turn this around and imagine if it was happening in an Islamic country to Christians, what kind of talk there would be, what kind of, you know, let yourself for a minute think like that, and you would understand that this looks to the whole world, what the United States is doing and what Israel is doing, as the last desperate gasps of white colonialism trying to control what we now call the global South. And, you know, we live at the end of a century of anti-colonialism. Those little countries in Europe don't control anything anymore. They once thought they controlled the whole world. The British like to say, the sun never sets on the British Empire because we have so much land in so many places that the sun is always up somewhere. You know, and they had such an empire. And they ripped that empire off. And eventually that empire told the British, go home. And that's why they don't control India and they don't control Africa the way they once did. Israel and the United States are efforts to keep settler colonialism alive. They don't have domestic opposition here because we genocidally killed off the indigenous population of this country when the Europeans came. Israel is trying to do that also to the Palestinians. It's not going to work. However long it takes, the resistance of the people of Gaza, what they have endured and stayed there, we will be wondering and trying to understand not only why the Israelis could and did do what they did, but how, where did the strength come from in the Palestinian people? Given what they have suffered there, it's absolutely extraordinary, and it will not continue much longer. Mr. Lula has a bit more courage than a lot of political leaders, and so he says things that are being thought by a lot of them, but they're diplomatic in the sense of softening what they say relative to what they believe. Mr. Lula is like that too, but Mr. Trump, you should all know, has been going after Mr. Lula with much more intensity than he has gone after many other global leaders. So you have there the clash of two people who are mad at each other. Over the last 2 months, Mr. Trump has particularly hit Brazil with high tariffs and threats of even higher ones, and has used as one of his concerns as to why he's doing that, he wants Mr. Lula to stop the prosecution of the previous leader of Brazil, a man named Bolsonaro, who is being put to trial because he's accused of major crimes. This is what we used to call interfering in the internal affairs of another country. It is not appropriate for the leader of the United States to mix into the internal political differences. We had a major struggle in this country over recent years when there was an accusation made that another country, Russia, might have interfered in the elections for president here in the United States. We were told by the people who were concerned how outrageous it would be for another country to interfere. And here we are doing it. Mr. Lula is not pleased since he's the current president, and he was jailed by Mr. Bolsonaro when Mr. Bolsonaro was the president. But here's the reason you need to pay attention, just to illustrate the wisdom, Sabrina, of what you said. Let's go back to coffee. Brazil is, I believe, the largest provider of coffee to the United States. If you put a heavy tariff on coffee, it's going to mean that, let's say, it costs $10 a pound to buy Brazilian coffee. If Mr. Trump hits them with a 25% or a 50% tariff, you're going to have to pay a buck to get Brazil to send the coffee and then pay Trump 25 or 50 cents more per dollar of the cost of your coffee because of the tariff, which means the price of your latte next week is going to go up a lot. So yeah, you have to pay attention, because if you pick up a latte on the way to work and you do it many days a week, you're going to be spending big bucks on coffee that you didn't have to do before. And if the BRICS countries decide, and they've been discussing this for years, to move away from reliance on the dollar, precisely because the American president is so aggressive to their hurt, to their detriment, yes, it will make an enormous difference. And let me summarize real quickly why. Brazil is a leading member of the BRICS nation. BRICS meaning B-R-I-C-S. The first initial of the names Brazil, Russia, India, China, and South Africa. But those five countries have now been joined by a dozen more, actually more than that. But if you add up right now the population of the BRICS countries in the world we live in, the planet we inhabit, it's already well over half the people of this planet live in those countries. What's the percentage of the world's population that lives in the United States? 4.5%. What are we doing as a nation when we try to control, to dominate, to interfere in, to hit with economic weapons a population many, many times bigger than us? You know, in the long run, that isn't just a failed idea, that's downright stupid. And we are in a place in our country where we're having economic difficulties, and we have a leader who's trying to make the rest of the world pay for our economic difficulties. And we wonder that they're not enthusiastic about it. They want to free themselves from being vulnerable to a powerful country like ours, saying the rest of the world has to pay taxes to us, not just to their own country, but to us in some way. We're going to sanction them and punish them and this and that. You're going to see a reaction over the years ahead for which the American people are not ready, because they don't understand, because they don't want to face what is in fact going on. Mr. Lula speaks the way he does because he knows that the majority of the people on this planet are cheering him on. They're not cheering Mr. Trump, not at all, but they are cheering the resistance to Mr. Trump from people like the President Lula. And Americans pay no attention to that, but they do so at their own peril.
That was Professor Richard D. Wolfe dissecting the economic undercurrents of our time, tariffs, BRICS, and the unraveling myth of American exceptionalism. While his analysis focused on trade wars and shifting global alliances, the implications go far beyond economic. Wolfe's message is clear. The United States, representing just 4.5% of the world's population, continues to act as if it owns the other 95.5%. Through decades of bipartisan leadership, Republican and Democrat alike, we've seen a pattern of imperial overreach, imposing tariffs, dictating foreign policy, backing Israel unconditionally, and punishing nations that dare to chart their own course. This isn't just about arrogance. It's about consequences. The world is watching and it's angry. From Latin America to the Middle East, from Africa to Southeast Asia, nations are organizing, resisting, and building alternatives. The BRICS coalition, Brazil, Russia, India, China, and South Africa, is no longer a footnote. It's a rising force, economically and politically, and it's challenging the dominance of Western institutions. You see where this is going, right? These policies of control, coercion, and complicity aren't sustainable. They're going to boomerang, and when they do, it won't be a slow unraveling. It'll be a reckoning, maybe tomorrow, maybe next year, but it's coming. And when it hits, it won't just be the U.S. economy that falters. It'll be the ideological scaffolding, the myth of moral authority, the illusion of global leadership, and yes, the uncritical support for Israel that begins to collapse under its own weight. This isn't fear-mongering, it's foresight. So listen closely, not just to Wolf's words, but to the silence they expose. The silence of a system that refuses to see its own decline. You are listening to This Week in Palestine, Truth and Justice Radio. Before we end today's episode, I want to take a moment to spotlight three urgent calls to action, each rooted in solidarity, resistance, and the refusal to remain silent in the face of genocide. The first one, Stand Out, Stop the Killing Boston. Every Tuesday from 12 to 1 p.m. community members gather outside the Zionist consulate at 20 Park Plaza in Boston for the Stand Out to Stop the Killing. This is more than a protest, it's a moral stand. A public witness against the ongoing genocide in Gaza. A collective act of conscience that declares silence is complicity. We will not look away. This weekly gathering is a space where voices rise for the voiceless, where presence becomes resistance, and where humanity is reclaimed in the face of systemic violence. If you're in the Boston area, show up. Your body, your voice, your care, they matter. The second one, North Shore for Palestine Salem Farmers Market. On Thursday, August 21st, from 4 p.m. to 6 p.m., join North Shore for Palestine at the Salem Farmers Market, 21 Front Street in Salem. This action demands an end to the starvation in Gaza and affirms our collective commitment to Palestinian liberation. If you're in the North Shore, come out and lend your support. This is a chance to connect, organize, and show that our communities will not be silent. Together, we stand for justice. Together, we make it impossible to ignore. The third one, mobilize for divestment campus and community campaigns. Across the country, students, faith leaders, and grassroots organizers are launching divestment campaigns targeting institutions that fund or profit from Israeli apartheid. Whether you're on a college campus, part of a congregation, or organizing locally, now is the time to demand that your institutions cut ties with genocide. Start a petition. Host a teach-in. Pressure your school board, city council, or union. The movement for divestment is growing and every voice adds weight. That brings us to the close of today's episode of This Week in Palestine. Stay curious, stay courageous, and keep asking the questions that challenge power and bring us closer to justice. Until next time, I'm your host, Muhammad Al-Ghul. It's been a true honor to share this space with you. If you have thoughts, questions, or want to support our work, we'd love to hear from you. Reach out anytime at twipodcast@gmail.com. A heartfelt thank you to you, our listeners, and to the brilliant team behind the scenes who make this show possible. Deep gratitude to Bob Funk, Stanley Robinson, Stephen Lowe, Sophia Rose Woolman, Tahani Abu Moza, Dr. Rana Awad, Dr. Bethany Marks, Juliet Salama Halavir, and Renad Al-Ghul. Your commitment and spirit fuel this platform. This Week in Palestine is a production of Truth and Justice Radio, proudly broadcasting from WZVC Student Radio at Boston College. Thank you for walking this path with us as we continue the journey toward Palestinian liberation. We'll be back next week. Until then, take care and stay steadfast.
Walk with me, my son, up over the hill. Let me show you the land where our memories still live. See those broken stones where the old house once stood. That was our home, where we laughed and we loved. that big farm right there with the olives so green. They stole it from us, you know what that means. We harvested life from the roots of these trees. Now they're strangers' hands taking all that we need. Look, son, that was our village. Now it's dust and it's pain. They came from the west with their guns and their chains. But remember,